outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Well, I tell you what, Kyle, closing escrow is not what it used to be.
Okay, how so?
We closed escrow this morning on our new house.
Uh-huh.
We will not see it for 2 weeks. This whole idea of the former owners get to squat in the house for a period of time because they're not ready to move out yet. So we bought a home. We own a home. We can't even go to our home today. I remember the old days, you get escrow closes, you get the keys, you shove up, and here we are. Yeah, that's not happening for me.
So what happens if while they're squatting for the next 2 weeks, they accidentally burn the house down and you own it?
Hopefully our insurance covers it for them.
Okay.
This is a whole new thing in real estate now, which I don't know how these things get started. Like when I first started in publishing, you know, if a bookstore bought a book, they owned the book, had to resell the book. Now they return the books for free. Just the industry changes so much. And now people sell you the home, but they don't actually give you the home. It's weird. I don't like it, but you know, what can I do? I buy one home every 20 years. I can't really change industry.
So do you have the keys? Do you actually have the keys though?
We have nothing. We closed escrow. We spent lots of money. We're now paying taxes for a property we can't inhabit. It's just the dumbest thing I've ever. But we're told this is common now that people want to sell their home and up to 30 days stay in it afterwards because they're not ready to move. Why? I'm ready to move. Why aren't they ready to move?
Yeah. Anyway. I was going to say, you're ready to get out of the apartment, right?
Yeah, but we won't be for a while because then we're going to have some work done on the house. It's a bit of a fixer-upper. Okay. So yeah, we got to do some things. So we're not going to move in right away anyway, but we would like to get started on some of those things, like spraying for the termites those filthy people left in. Oh, and I'm sorry, not filthy people.
Oh, yikes.
It's a deal out here in California. This area of California has lots of termites. So
okay.
We got to tent the monkey and extinguish them all and make some repairs where the damage is, but. All that's part great. Of life, okay. Right? It doesn't go smoothly.
That's right.
How about you? How's your week?
Honestly?
No, I want you to lie to me.
Well,
I always like when you do that. Honestly? No, lie to me. Let's just do a comedy bit here. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. Let's just
we'll just do a straight up improv. We'll just go for it.
Yeah. No,
that's going honestly. I had a pretty rough scare this week. I was in a counseling session with a client this week and came out and had a notification that there was an active shooter in the school building that my sister and brother-in-law work in.
Oh my gosh.
And there was no notification. Like all I got was you're currently on lockdown. There's an active shooter in the building. And that was all the information I had. And so
but that's not your building, right? That's not where you were. That's where you're.
No, I wasn't there. Okay. But
why'd you get a notice like that? You're under lockdown.
Because I'm a part of, because my company provides services to the entire panhandle, we're a part of every emergency system in the schools that we serve.
Okay.
And so as soon as that notification went out, it came across on my phone that the school district was on lockdown, that there was an active shooter in the building, that three kids had already been shot. This was the notification that we got.
Wow.
Well, it was a swatting call.
Oh, gosh.
Somebody literally called in through a Google voicemail number to do a talk. Like, it's a TikTok trend right now. And so, I was calling my sister. I was calling my brother-in-law. I couldn't get through to my sister. And then thankfully was able to get a hold of my brother-in-law. And he was like, no, actually we're no longer in lockdown. It was a hoax. It was a crank call that somebody called in. But man, I haven't had my stomach drop like that in a long time.
Wow.
It was scary.
How strange. Boy, what people do for a good time, huh? And just to be clear, here on the God Journey, we're not recommending your participation in that TikTok challenge.
No, because if the FBI is actually able to track down that person's IP address, there will be several felonies. So it will not be a good experience for that person.
You're going to get room and board for a while. Free of charge.
And three free meals, but it's going to be very limited access.
Yes, not going to be good. Man. What a crazy world we live in, eh?
Yeah. The fact that anybody would think that that was even remotely funny or a good idea, or why not just for the fun of it. Like, but it was interesting, like, to hear my sister and brother-in-law's response to it. you know, my sister is, she's going to be having a baby in a month. And her immediate mode was full on protection of her students. She's barricading the door. She's grabbing weapons that can be used. She like, and it was really interesting because she just made the comment, you don't know how you're going to respond in that situation until the active call goes out. And then in that moment, you never know how you're going to actually act. And yeah. She was reflecting back on it and was actually quite encouraged by the way that she responded. But whew.
I've got a friend who's an Uber driver up in the Portland area, and he wrote me a couple weeks ago, picked up somebody, if I remember right, Saturday night, Friday night, somehow weekend night, lady, African-American woman gets in his car, just in tears, just disheveled. And she finally collects enough to tell him she needs to get to the hospital because her brother just shot himself in the head. And she's talking about this with him. As they get to the hospital, she says to him, why is my generation of people killing ourselves? This makes no sense at all. Something is wrong with us. We are sick. And then on the around the heels of that, I see a new report by the CDC. I know CDC isn't popular with everybody, but this is a report on the crisis in American girlhood. And it's a youth risk behavior survey. And just some of the stats from what Sarah and I have been through recently and what we hold in our hearts more clearly now. Nearly one in three high school girls said they considered suicide. A 60% rise in the past decade. Nearly 15% have been forced to have sex. About 6 in 10 girls were so persistently sad or hopeless they stopped regular activities. 24% of teen girls have made a plan for suicide, while 13% have attempted it, twice the rate for boys. A generation of young women who have endured an extraordinary level of sadness and sexual violence, growing up in a social media culture with impossible beauty standards, online hate, academic pressure, economic difficulties, self-doubt, and sexual violence. The isolation and upheaval of COVID made it tougher still. Teens are really good at hiding it, which is really sad. And that's any parent of a teenager will know, man, they're really good at hiding the pain. And Sarah and I went over this stuff realizing Sarah was really good at hiding it too. And she wasn't a teenager. She's in her 60s, but... And then Harvard psychologist Richard Weisbord points out that girls are more likely to respond to pain in the world by internalizing conflict and stress and fear, and boys are more likely to translate those feelings into anger and aggression to mask their depression. You work in this, man. Is that?
I do.
How does this sound to you? Legit?
It sounds spot on, honestly, for the demographics that I work with. And in 2014, when I first started working in the field professionally, it took 3 years of me working in the field before I ever had to do a suicide assessment of someone, and just to determine whether or not they were okay, if we needed to do a potential hospitalization, you know, that kind of thing. I do, on average right now, I do one every other week.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just in two school districts where I am actively discerning whether, trying to discern whether or not somebody's going to take their own life if they're a threat to themselves.
Two very small school districts, right?
Yep.
In a rural area. So I think this is a big city area. Problem, urban area problem. You're not talking that. That's not the school you're in.
No.
And then some people just so easily throw it to social media and all the competition and TikTok and all that. And that really isn't enough to explain it, is it?
I think it points at a much deeper issue, and it's the intense feeling of disconnect, of relational isolation that so many young people feel. TikTok and other social media platforms has exponentially grown that, but there's a lot of other contributing factors that are involved too. The amount of students that I hear that don't have an adult in their life that they can trust. And that's a direct family member. That's an extended family member. That's a community member. That often I get feedback that I'm one of the first adults that they've ever been able to trust in their life. And it's like, how? You're 15, 16, 17, 18. How have you gone this long and not had somebody who was relationally safe enough that you were able to allow yourself to be seen and heard and feel seen and heard in a non-judging way, in a safe way?
Yeah, and that isolation has always been weaponized a little. Even in school when I grew up, there's the crowd, the in crowd,
yeah.
And there's marginalized people. There's people everybody makes fun of. The Mean Girls wasn't just a movie.
Yeah,
my granddaughter is experiencing it in the high school she goes to. This group of mean girls that you either go along with what we say or will isolate you or harass you in some way. And it just goes on in the schools. I don't know that they can do enough about it, but social media just weaponizes it even further. You can bash on folks that are not even school, make fun of them. Yeah. And man, when the comment from that lady, when she just said, there's something wrong with us, we are sick. You know, I hear those things very differently now, especially in light of the agony of God we talked about last week.
Yeah.
It was just one thing to hear those statistics go, yeah, that's some social media, stupid kids. And man, you hear a 60% rise in the kinds of behaviors that are destructive. You even talking about how many suicide risk things you fill out. And I just, it hurts my heart in ways that never hurt my heart before. And I don't work in it. I just hear the stories. I hear from families where it's happened. I just, wow, no wonder God holds the pain of the world in his heart. And to think that God is somehow just separated from that, going, you stupid fool humans, you've created this world for yourselves. Go ahead and that's so not the God we know, who feels the pain of every child who feels the need, or adult who feels the need to end their life because they're so hopeless with options or so much in pain. And my gosh, reach out. He is there. God's coming to rescue. He cares. And find someone who cares. Find someone. Yeah. Who will care for you and care about you.
Yeah, and I think part of one of the discussions that's taking place in my field right now is the whole dialogue about mental health. And are we actually, when we talk about mental health, are we actually moving towards health? You know, that there's been a lot of dialogue about, oh, well, we're just dealing with the chronically mentally ill, or as soon as you experience a form of anxiety, then automatically you have a disorder. And yet there's not those conversations about, okay, what does it actually look and mean with regards to moving towards more wholehearted living? What does it actually mean to be pressing towards mental health, and health being the primary key word in that? Because often when we hear health, we're actually comparing that and then going the opposite direction and thinking about the extreme mental challenges that people are facing on a regular basis.
Well, you don't hear mental health except when someone's talking about they have mental health issues. So you hear it in the negative almost always.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I was listening to a podcast this week and just was really encouraged because the person on it was an anxiety researcher. They've been working in the field of anxiety for over 20 years. And they made the comment about how positive and how beneficial anxiety actually is to people. And exploring it through more of a positive, helpful lens versus just immediately prescribing it as a major illness or as a major downfall, or there's something wrong with you.
Or something you need to be medicated for.
Yes. And I was having a conversation earlier this week, and it was just really intriguing because they said, well, why not just have a dialogue? Why can't we be more preventative about this? Why can't we be, if I'm a fairly functional individual, why can't I still go to counseling? Why can't I still pursue coaching or counseling or some form of support in that process? And because often it's like, well, unless it's completely disrupting your life, then we don't ask for help. Instead of doing that preventative work, and this psychologist used the term mental fitness, of where you're actually working out and actually building up endurance and resiliency. So when hard times do come, which they are going to, it doesn't completely wipe you out. It's, oh no, I've actually developed this resiliency. I've navigated some hard things. I've felt that tingle of anxiety, but also, you know, like for me, when I go to do a training or do public speaking, there's this combination of like that churning, tingling in my stomach, but I'm also excited. Like if I have that, in my stomach, if I have those butterflies a little bit, that helps me really focus and channel my energy to bring my best to what I'm doing. And the psychologist looks at it through that lens of what would it look like to be able to actually harness some of those feelings, those emotions, and move them in a positive way to actually be to your benefit.
Wow, that would take some restructuring, I think, for people's lives. The idea that this anxiety may not be a negative, that the anxiety is going to help me focus, lean into Jesus if we have that component in our lives, and I hope we do, to be able to go, okay, now how do I rise to this challenge? Because he said last week, that the sorrow is more valuable than laughter because it probes the depth of the heart. So anxiety, if there's something coming your way you think is bigger than you, now you have some options to deal with it. And I think a lot of that podcast, because you shared it with me, was talking a lot about anxiety of uncertainty, which I dealt with a lot in my life at a younger age, but never, I guess I never think of anxiety as a problem because I don't think of it in a clinical way, like you're paralyzed with anxiety. I just always think, okay, this is challenging. I'm not sure what I'm going to do about it yet. So I have this angst in my, my gut. I always feel it in my gut. I have this angst. Somehow either the situation passes or I find a way to navigate through it or whatever. So it's never been something that I've been afraid of. I enjoy it. I much prefer to be comfortable as opposed to anxious about anything coming my way. But anxiety, I think that was the point of the podcast. Anxiety can serve you well if it doesn't paralyze you.
In the podcast, they make the clear distinction that there are people who are actually navigating an anxiety disorder where it is debilitating, where it is, and that's not the type of anxiety they're talking about. They're talking about those feelings that I've got a good friend that's a phenomenal life coach, and he always talks about how if you're not living life where there's a little bit of angst and there's a little bit of, I don't know how this is going to come out, a little bit of that uncertainty, then you're living a very comfortable and safe life. And for him, he really wants to encourage his clients to be able to live in that space where they kind of feel like they're on the edge on a regular basis, because then that's when you're being more creative. That's when you're leaning into faith. That's when you are depending on something more than just yourself. What does that look like to live that type of life?
Oh, I think that's true. I think it may be safe and comfortable, but it's also usually meaningless. You know, kind of life that isn't challenged, that you don't choose things in your life, whether it's public speaking, whether it's confronting a challenge, or like we talk about people that have trauma in their past and have never taken it on because they're too afraid of what's down that rabbit hole. To be able to have a resiliency of faith and heart and life that says, hey, when God's ready for me to face a challenge, or I'm ready to face a challenge, it's not going to kill me. I can get through this. I can, if there's anxiety about it, find the support I need, find brothers or sisters who come alongside, who pray, carry me, have it on their heart. I'll have them on mine. I do agree. I think that a challengeless life is usually a pretty empty life, all told. Because some of the greatest moments in life come when you have survived a challenge or overcome a challenge or overcome a very difficult thing and found God's way through it. And then it's like, oh my gosh, there's things I can do that God in me really is strong. I think in a religious construct, I mean, I think about when we talk about anxiety, I thought about this when I listened to podcasts, Jesus said, be anxious for nothing. And that's an easy thing to say to people. Just be anxious for nothing. That's what Jesus said. He told us not to be anxious, so stop it. And they did talk in the podcast that anxiety is a feeling. It's not a choice. You don't choose anxiety. It's a feeling. It's a sense of insecurity about something coming my way that I might not be big enough to handle alone. And if that's there, then you're going to be looking for resources outside yourself to help you manage it. And if the anxiety is not there, then you kind of walk into it unprepared to negotiate it.
Yeah.
And the other anxiety I think about a lot is the anxiety of just, and they talked about this some on the podcast, our imagined futures, which are rarely as bad as we imagine them to be. So And that's the kind of anxiety I think Jesus is really trying to set us free from. Look, don't be, your Father knows what you need before you get there. So don't borrow the anxiety of tomorrow today. There's enough, he actually says this in Matthew, say there's enough worry each day of itself.
Yeah.
You don't need to borrow.
Yeah, don't borrow tomorrow's trouble. Just worry about today's.
And yet that's all easier said than done, all easier to counsel people and even kind of shove anxiety almost in a form of denial. I'm not anxious. I trust Jesus. No. If there's that ping in your gut, deal with it. Invite Jesus into it. Get through it. Find out that your resources are bigger than you. It involves him and involves his family. And I hope these young people who are in such, and if you have young people in your home, and what's the best advice to give parents? You got teenagers, they look like they're doing well, but I realize there's some real risk in that whole community. What do I watch for?
Ooh, that is a great, well, now you're catching me off guard. I wasn't expecting that question.
Okay. How can I remain oblivious to the need of my children?
There's a few different things for sure. I mean, for example, watching changes in behavior. So if there is a pretty significant change in their routine, if you have a young person that, for example, like their eating habits change, their sleeping patterns change, they're seeing a loss, you're seeing a reduction in them participating in things that they normally found pleasure in or that they were having fun with. If you see them disconnecting from a peer group that they used to be able to really spend time with, or if you hear a group of teens, like a group of peers' names that all of a sudden start disappearing, they used to talk about them a bunch and then all of a sudden they're gone. What happened to that? What's going on there that happened relationally that all of a sudden they're not bringing them up as frequently? Sleep patterns are a really big thing with teens. And so watching the sleep patterns, are they actually getting enough sleep? Do you hear them getting up multiple times in the night and are moving around the house, that type of thing? Is that something that's going on?
Yeah.
So those would be a couple of the different things, but I think one of the things that, so we were talking again about the medical model of mental health. And so, you know, it's almost like the Western medical model of we only seek out mental health when we need significant surgery versus doing those preventative relational things. Because when we do the initial groundwork to really build into the relationship, when we are pausing in our life and creating, so for example, one of the parenting programs, trainings that I went through, they talked about having specific time for each of your kids consistently and calling it like their special time or however you want to, whatever language you want to put around it. But basically having at least every other day, if not daily, having a time where you're connecting with that individual and they are the focus of your attention. There's nothing else that's distracting you. They are the highlight. They're on spotlight and you're just taking pleasure in who they are. That's going to be a preventative tool that's going to keep those relational connections, those lines of communication open. You're going to even be able to notice those sometimes subtle changes in performance or behavior or attitude because you're checked in. You're attuned. You're a part of it. You're involved. And this really takes intentionality on parents' behalf, because as a parent of a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, it is tough when you're trying to start a business. Like, I'm cultivating my own private business. I've got my other clients. I'm trying to connect with my wife, like all the other demands of life. But I need to, and have been trying to intentionally spend between 10 to 15 minutes every single night where that either Evie or Elle are the sole focus of my eye. There's nothing else that is distracting me. My phone isn't even in the same room. And I'm engaging and paying attention to them.
And that's easier to do, I think, when you have young kids, toddlers like that. You get a teenager where you all of a sudden say, hey, we're going to get 10 minutes a day of quality time together. And the teenager's like, oh, crud. You have to be creative to find something into your child's heart. That's not just, absolutely, you need to spend 15 extra minutes with mommy every day, whether you like it or not, you know? And it does take, I think when you start it at a younger age, it's easier to hold on to when they're older. And if you're starting when they're older, just say, hey, listen, I've been missing you. Let's go out to have a milkshake together. Let's find some way to be together that's kind of fun. Not just, we're going to sit down, you're going to tell me what's going on, and if you've had any suicidal thoughts. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah, you freak your teenager right out into nothing.
Yes, they will run so fast.
I was going to say, the change of patterns, I think, is huge. Just to notice they're not eating the same way. They're not out the same way. They're not talking about their friends the same way. And everything looks more depressive, more darker. Mm-hmm. Find a way into that heart and suggest to get help if you feel like that's an important part of what they need to do.
and going through what are the signs and symptoms, what are the physiological responses of trauma, et cetera, so that these peers are able to recognize and identify when one of their friends is struggling. Hmm. And so then they can actually ask for help. They can actually say, okay, no, this is more than just, I ate a bad steak last night. It goes beyond that.
Wow. The times we live in.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll find our way through that. Best thing you heard this week? We're way late today. This will be fun.
We are way late. I think the two things that really came up for me was the mental fitness that was brought up in the podcast and looking at it through that way. And then, so the group that I mentioned in the last week where I questioned Paul and it went dead silent.
Yep.
We met with them again this week and we were talking and dialoguing. And one of the other people in the group actually kind of paused the conversation. They were talking and they paused the conversation, what they were saying. They're like, Kyle, I'd love to hear what you have to say because you kind of have a very different and kind of a non-traditional perspective. And I would really appreciate hearing what your perspective is on this. And that was really intriguing to me to have them pause the conversation and say, no, we actually value the fact that you're potentially quite a bit different than the way that we perceive this. That was encouraging. And I was able to kind of give some insight and thought to it. And that was fun to be able to see that.
That's great. You didn't silence your phone, did you?
I did silence my phone, but it came through on my computer as well. I don't know how to silence my computer. I don't know how to put my computer on Do Not Disturb.
takes a different challenge, I guess. I have no idea.
So if somebody knows how to do that on an Apple, let me know. What's the best thing you heard this week?
I got an email, I think Saturday, and this is from a friend of mine in Colorado. And here's what he wrote. And it's kind of personal, but it was still fun. He said, driving today to Wyoming and listening to the February 17th podcast, Sarah's laughter at the end is something I've never heard from her. That quick, genuine, free moment held with it so much hope for everyone I know that has experienced trauma. I sense God's satisfaction and his own joy in the lightness of her voice. Thanks for inviting us along this gloriously painful journey, which kind of goes with excruciatingly beautiful and a few of the other things we have around here. I read that to Sarah because I thought it was delightful. I've always talked about Sarah's laugh as one of those endearing things about her. And when I read it to her, she goes, I hope it does that. And I said, what? That it encourages people who are lost in the trauma. But we couldn't remember what that laugh was. We'd go like, what is he talking about? That was a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So we went back and picked it up. And so everyone else doesn't have to go back and let's do it. Here's what that was like. Well, babe, thank you for coming back.
You're welcome.
And I mean that in a variety of ways. But thanks for coming back on the podcast is how I meant it this time.
Thanks for coming back, Brack.
Yeah, that's that delightful laugh. I love that. And as Sarah said, if that helps other people. Find their way to have some hope that no matter how dark it may seem for, because right a year ago now, very dark for Sarah, incredibly dark. And to have that healing, that present, we had a major breakthrough last week, may talk about it sometime, not sure, but just a beautiful understanding of forgiveness for her trauma that is hers to share. Because people talk about that a lot, like, we've never tried to work at forgiveness for Sarah because I don't think we're down in the pain enough to start forgiving. Otherwise, you're going to forgive a million times, right? Because we forgive up there and then, oh, no, it's worse than that. And, that person was involved too. And it was just a beautiful way and a picture, an image that God gave her. And she didn't even know God gave it. She was telling me about this thing. I'm sitting there listening to her share it one day. And I looked there and I said, so where did that come? Did somebody give that to you? I said, it's just a thought I had. I said, might it be God gave you that as a picture of something? A couple of days later, she said, thank you. She said, I think I would have missed that being God. And I said, I think that's true for a lot of people. God's doing wonderful stuff to help them navigate life. Yeah. But they don't know it's him. They just think, maybe I had a good thought or a lot of pieces of a puzzle came together. But who's the puzzle maker? Who's the one bringing those things together? And so anyway, we've had a glorious time with that. That laughter is so inviting. And I want it like Sarah does to encourage those of you who are still caught in the throes of agony to know that God's in that with you, with his agony, And then there does come liberty. There does come freedom. That's what binding up the brokenhearted means, that God's able to bring all that together in a neat place.
Hmm.
We don't have much time left, unfortunately. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I gave you this line, it might have been a month ago now, that I read from an email. And I only gave that line because the person who had written me asked me to keep it confidential. And for people who write me, I get that often, I say, Wayne, this is personal. Don't read it on the God Journey or quote it on the blog. And I respect that all the time. In fact, if it's really personal and I want to quote it, I'm going to ask first.
Yeah.
And if I don't ask, I won't use it because I don't want people to feel caught unawares. She did write back after that to say, hey, go ahead and feel free to use it. She said, I spent the year working to grow in a relationship with God. Remember the COVID thing? She couldn't attend her normal fellowship. He said,
yeah.
He rocked my world, showing me the ugliest lies I tell myself and the most beautiful truths I still struggle to accept. I said at the time when I read that, it's just the definition of transformation that is that most of what I believe about myself, particularly the ugly stuff I believe about myself, is probably not true. But if you perceive it as true, it's going to take you under.
Yeah.
And these wonderful things about God that we tend to exclude ourselves from, like, it's not for me. He's not going to be that way with me. He's not going to give me the laughter that he's given Sarah. She said, the shame I felt was a lifetime of insecurity and doubt, self-hatred and self-condemnation. Throughout the years, my relationship with Jesus has grown so big. It's been incredible to discover and experience over time, like a tangled ball of yarn or Christmas lights or whatever. Yeah. I discovered my relationship with God the Father is insanely broken. You see, I was convinced I am bad. I was convinced I am unworthy and unlovable. I hated myself. On top of this, I could hear stories in the Old Testament and be angry with God and wonder how he could kill entire cities of people, children. Why does God allow people to be stoned or for giving in to temptation in a moment of weakness, taking something after a battle? God is angry. God is quick to punish. God certainly must hate me. And this God I discovered, I hate him too. Those are some of the ugly lies that she worked through. It was both liberating and terrifying to discover the truth. I learned that years of trauma and negative self-talk created this angry image of God in my mind. I learned that my inner self-talk and voice needs to change, and slowly it is. I'm learning the truth about love and grace. I'm picturing a God that cheers me on while I run, one who embraces me, looks into my eyes with admiration, and tells me he loves me. He's there fighting for me in this wild spiritual warfare. I keep feeling God remind me and gently point out, child, this isn't what matters. This is all just a distraction. I love you, and love is all that matters. I'm still fighting these battles, still working through the pain and hurt and loss, but I'm clinging to his grace. And books like He Loves Me and What's So Amazing About Grace and the Ragamuffin Bible have been books on, even books on trauma, have been so helpful in my healing process. Thank you for your focus on love, rest, and play. Your podcast and books have carried me through some painful times. I guess I'd say after the thing with Sarah's laughter, I want that to encourage people who feel like they're still on the other side of that. I got one email here from someone that said, I realized for my dad, legalism is love. Talking about growing up in that same repressive kind of childhood. What a powerful statement. For my dad, legalism is love. And the abuse he edited out to me caused unbelievable torment. And I've heard that so much from people raised by folks who are in legalistic environments. I mean, we hear it all the time. They're going to beat the devil out of you. That's what they were taught. You know, we're going to fix this with discipline and anger. And then God begins to take on that persona with people. This lady who wrote that line about my dad, legalism is love, she said, during the last year, I've experienced a gut-wrenching amount of pain around my relationship with my earthly father. The pain made it piercingly apparent to me why I struggled intensely with seeing God as my father. Wayne, when I saw the title of your book in a recent Facebook post by a friend, my heart felt a small stirring of hope. I purchased your book, and then I found Transition Series. Things I always thought were true about God and true about specific scripture passages were validated by your contextual study of the Bible verses. I came to accept the painful truth that the fear-based doctrine of the church I grew up in was and is my dad's father. Isn't that a line? It was my dad's father. For my dad, legalism is love. The truth of these statements and the abuse that was meted out to me has caused unbelievable torment. Wow. I love that we're talking about those kinds of things with people. I love that people kind of wake up to the idea that there's a difference between who God is and the legalism in which I was schooled by him. There's ways, and we do it in the Jesus lens. For those of you who have never heard it, I can't imagine who that would be. As Kyle told me, he heard it for the first time last week or something. He went, really? Really? Your contract to be a Coast of God Journey didn't include this? And memorize.
I missed that one.
The Jesus lens. There's ways to go back to those passages and see them not when they're used to build fear in people, which is what most religious leaders do, because fear is their best tool to manipulate people. And they don't realize love is the best way to motivate people. They don't know that yet. And so we use the Bible to beat people up. But there's explanations for all that. That doesn't position God as the angry deity removed from our stresses and problems and just angry and bashing people who don't get it right, is slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness. And that's Old Testament language. It's not just New Testament language.
I love the distinction or the tension that she outlined talking about. It's liberating and terrifying at the same time. I love that language because I feel like that is so true, that it's like, man, if this is actually true, If this is the kind of God that he is, if this is the kind of love that he wants to put out into the world, like, that's an interesting story. That's what I want to connect with. That's the type of life I want to live. But, oh my gosh, that is scary. That goes so against like my concept, the way that I've done life in the past, the way that others around me still relate with God, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, man, I deeply appreciate that tension. I feel like that's such a beautifully accurate statement.
Yeah, and that comes up repeatedly over the years, from gratefully disillusioned to excruciatingly beautiful to gloriously painful to terrifyingly liberating or whatever. There's a real tension in this journey, which I think makes it such a narrow road that just talks about few there be who find it, not because God doesn't want them to, but because to see truth, to see the horrible thing, lies you believe about yourself, and to see the beautiful truths about God that you don't know, that takes a willingness to I'd be uncomfortable. I mean, it does take something to go, okay, my upbringing may not have been the best, and I may have to take a look at who God is. And it is terrifying. I mean, all Sarah could have just stayed in this apartment for, you know, the next 20 years and lived alone and lived a somewhat life, lonely, I would have thought, but manageable, maybe comfortable, perhaps. But man, she took the hard look down deep. She went there, and it's so worth it. I can't imagine how scary it was for Sarah. I can't. Yeah. I try to, when it first starts to emerge, can you run from it? Push it back down, take off? Yes. I don't want to go down that road. I'm too old to get back to it. I just don't want to. But Sarah didn't. Sarah just kept going at it. And the letters I read today, someone else in their 60s. In fact, this same lady who wrote the thing about my dad, legalism is love, she continued with this: Sarah, your willingness to share your story became part of this connection. I experienced emotional incest along with some physical sexual abuse in my relationship with my dad. I am in my 60s and have felt incredible horror and confusion as to why this abuse is now having such a profound and sickening effect on me. Well, I am so deeply sad that you experienced the horrific abuse. I am so thankful to know that another woman in her 60s was able to work through this with God. I know you are still healing. Thank you for your continued courage. And Wayne, thank you for showing me that there can be true humility and love from a man to a woman. You had to lean hard on God to love Sarah through such a confusing and painful time. This truth brings me full circle to my need to trust my Abba Father.
We got into that conversation actually a little bit this weekend about the deep work that goes on both sides of forgiveness, right? So whether you're the person that's asking for forgiveness or the person that is giving the forgiveness, right? Like the deep work that's required on both sides, right? Like Sarah had to do some deep work on her side to be able to look at the pain, to be able to not just shove it down and ignore it or exit and then live in the semi-manageable life that she was going to give. And vice versa on your side, you had to lean hard into Father's heart in that regard too, of there are people around me that are telling me there's a less than 1% chance that I'm going to get my marriage back. And yet I'm going to hold hope for that less than 1% because I don't know anything else to do. And man, just navigating that, I feel like as we press into life, especially in the context of a couple, but it could be other relationships in our lives too, it presses us into a deeper divine dependency on both sides as we're doing that work and moving into that deeper relational space.
And ultimately, it's still the same thing. It's still, What are ugly lies that I believe?
Yeah.
What are beautiful truths I'm missing?
Yeah.
And if people could make that little shift, because I know our conclusions about God, that God doesn't care. He doesn't care about me. He didn't protect me from that. So obviously he can't love me. And those feel so true to people who buy that. That to risk that view of God and to go, maybe I've missed something and maybe those are lies. That's the worst person in the world is the one who believes a lie that's damaging. They believe the lie. They're not liars. Yeah. They don't know they're lied to, or they believe the lie. And I guess when Jesus says the darkness in you is, when the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? When you think what you know is true, that can be captivating for years and years and years. But if you just risk, maybe God, maybe what I believe about me isn't true. And maybe there's beautiful things about God that I've missed because I got this religious God who's not very endearing. If you've rejected the religious God, join the club. I've rejected that God too. But there is a God who deeply loves and heals and comes running to us in our pain and wants to help us find a way out. And like we talked about for some of those teenage girls at the beginning of this podcast, that often takes some help. Sarah has gotten help. And if you're lost in that kind of darkness, don't think you got to manage it alone. You don't. Find an adult who can hold space with your pain. And for those who listen to this podcast or have for years, be a person that can hold space with people in pain. Find the, which we've been talking about the last few weeks, find the emotional capacity. Now, we were reading the parable the other day about the 10 virgins and the 5 that didn't have enough oil and the 5 that had enough. And it just seems, the way it is, it just seems kind of like a cruel parable. But I think the heart of the parable is this: live with enough resource for more than yourself. There's people around you. And if you don't have any resource more for yourself, then let God heal that so you can.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of broken people, lots of hurting people around you. Where you live, where you're at, there's people that need to be loved, held space with while they process deep, dark stuff so that God can actually bind up the brokenhearted, set the captive free, and teach us to laugh again in the joy of the Lord.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.